This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi.
With former prosecutor and guest Lori Gilbertson.
The case against Richard Allen, we're getting closer and closer to the actual trial date, but there's more questions, more drama, as there always is in this case. Dr. Monica Walla in question, a therapist who treated Richard Allen while he was detained at the Wabash Correctional Facility. The defense is arguing and alleging that Walla had a strong personal interest in the case to begin with, and that would compromise her objectivity. Also posting things on social media about the case, recommending podcasts about the case. Joining me to discuss, Lori Gilbertson, former prosecutor. Is this a big deal? Is this a red herring? I'm still trying to wrap my mind around why this is as much of an issue as they're trying to make it out to be.
Yeah, Tony, I have exactly the same question. You know, this is a therapist who, I guess, treated him once he had already been arrested and is already incarcerated for this crime awaiting trial. So it has nothing to do with the investigation into him. It has nothing to do with his ultimate arrest, has nothing to do with his indictment, and really doesn't have much to do with his trial unless she is going to be testifying about something that is important in the case. If mental status or mental illness is an important factor in the case, then maybe it would come to play. Other than that, all it's really showcasing is someone who was not using good professional or ethical judgment in her job and her role treating someone.
The one thing that could come to my mind on this is he's confessed to the murders like 60 plus times. But at the same time, but at the same time, he was also eating his own poop. So it's kind of one of those things where how accurate are those confessions if that's what's going on? And I'm wondering if Dr. Walla was there, you know, kind of trying to counsel this man as he was losing his mind. Now he's, of course, saying, that wasn't me when I was making those confessions. I was not in the right state of mind. I wonder if there's some concern there that the doctor may have the outlook that, he made these confessions and they were of sound mind.
She may have that, and that could obviously be relevant. I think it has been ruled that those confessions are coming in, and the confessions started way in the beginning with a phone call to his wife, right, that was able to be transcribed where he confessed, and then he was confessing to the warden, and then he was confessing to the guards who were walking him back and forth. You know, you talk about confessing once, that's one thing. You talk about five times. As a prosecutor, you're like, great.
Yeah.
You know, this guy's telling me exactly what he's doing. When you get up into the 60s, you know, it really sounds like this is someone who wants to tell everyone what he did and wants to get this all off his chest. And as a prosecutor, that's what I would be looking at. And then also looking at what corroborates these confessions. You know, yes, he is exhibiting mental illness in other ways, but what corroborates this? What are the things that we have in evidence that we've seen that we have from other witnesses and other evidence that corroborates what he's telling us? Because that gives it more credibility. And then the idea that this is just something that's fabricated or this guy is just nuts and spewing off for who knows what reason becomes less and less likely. So with this therapist here, you know, I think we don't know enough yet. And that's really what the defense is trying to get at. I don't think it's a red herring at all. I mean, a red herring in the sense that it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. It doesn't seem to be too relevant, but except for kind of the ethical and the judgment of this person.
And I mean, the 60 confessions are bizarre. He made them to his wife. He's made it to guards. He's made it to all different people. The fact that he was in solitary confinement immediately, he didn't go to the county jail. Now he's finally in a county jail after 2 years in solitary confinement, going from being the CVS employee and a father and a husband and living a fairly normal life to suddenly you're in that sort of situation. No criminal history whatsoever with this guy. And from what we understand, the guards, I mean, it was like cruel and unusual. I mean, it's something that really needs to be looked into. And I think they may be reevaluating some of their standards, but it sounded absolutely hellish and horrible for this guy who is innocent until proven guilty and doesn't really have a lot of solid evidence against him. if you're in that sort of situation of this hell, at some point, I would imagine you're going to say almost anything you can to get out of that torture. Is that going to be a strong argument if they try to make that in the case after the fact of all those confessions?
I mean, that could certainly be a defense argument. I agree with you, Tony, unless it's a real severe case where there is such a proven danger that this person has to other people. Mm-hmm. Being in solitary confinement for 2 years could certainly drive absolutely anyone mm-hmm. insane. It truly is yeah. cruel and unusual punishment. There have been so many, you know, studies and real world instances to show that. I don't know how confessing is necessarily the idea of what would get him out of that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's something that the defense would have to put forward with some more evidence. And, you know, and that is probably going to have to come from the defendant in this case. There's really not many people who could testify to that unless they're trying to use the therapist to testify to that. That's why she's important here.
Sure. Do you see more confessions by people who are in solitary confinement versus general population?
Not at all.
No.
Not at all. I mean, most confessions will come in the beginning.
Okay.
And they will come when someone has been first arrested and are being interrogated and want to tell their side of the story. Mm-hmm. And they want to tell what happened and everything is fresh and they're in this situation and they just want to get it out. And often when people are what we would term a confession, they think that they are just telling their side of the story mm-hmm. and that there may not necessarily even be any criminality to what they've done. Mm-hmm. They just want to get the information out. And then those things can often become confessions or be termed as confessions because we have the evidence to back up what they're doing, to corroborate what they're doing. You know, an example of that would be someone who maybe is a getaway driver mm-hmm. in a robbery. And they say, oh, well, I just drove my friends away. I didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah.
Well, that's crime. So often people will talk about that because they think they're not really confessing to mm-hmm. anything. The other ways it comes in are the way it did in this case, where he made so many phone calls while he was in a state correctional facility. Those phone calls are taped mm-hmm. and recorded. The people making the phone calls, the inmates know they are taped and recorded, and yet you will get so many confessions that way. Mm-hmm. Maybe something about talking to loved ones or just talking on the phone and they don't think about it. But I saw so many confessions and was able to use so much evidence that way because it's their own words, speaking voluntarily, even though it is from being incarcerated. And those often proved, you know, incredibly helpful in cases. So I can see where the prosecutor is going using this, and I can see where the defense wants to put up the arguments you're mentioning.
When you have those confessions out there, how mm-hmm. difficult is it to backpedal on that and sway a jury the other way of, oh, you know, he was not in the right mind or he didn't mean it? Or is it like really sway your odds of being convicted once those things have been out there?
Well, confessions are incredibly powerful because it's coming from the defendant's mm-hmm. own mouth. They're telling you information that often law enforcement doesn't know, that no other witnesses know, and that can often go to their intent and their state of mind. So they are powerful things. We also have these powerful safeguards where the judge will have a hearing beforehand to make sure that confession is voluntary, that there wasn't any police activity that forced a confession at all, because there are forced confessions, mm-hmm. unfortunately. So there will be that whole kind of hearing. By the time it goes in front of a jury, that has all happened. And so those kind of indicia of it being reliable have already happened. And so then it's very difficult, I think, as a defendant or defense attorney to argue against a confession.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating case. We'll see where it happens. And when it goes mm-hmm. to trial here in October, if that date stays, everything changes in this case. So who knows?
You're neck deep in a dark, twisted tale. And just as the tension peaks, bam, a commercial about some miracle diet pill breaks the spell. It's like finding a fly in your soup after the first bite. But here's the fix. True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts. You get to enjoy your crime stories without the junk. Ad-free episodes, extended interviews that go beyond the surface, and early access to all the gruesome details. It's like swapping out a can of cheap beer for a glass of fine whiskey. So search for True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts subscribe, and keep the darkness flowing uninterrupted.